Welcome to the South Fellowship Church podcast. Here at South Fellowship, we exist to help people live in the way of Jesus with the heart of Jesus. Wherever you're listening from today, we hope you're encouraged by this week's message.
Good morning, friends. How are you doing today? It's Holy Week. I don't know about you, this week is one of those weeks that is, perhaps the word is conflicting. Perhaps the word is an emotional roller coaster. We're going to navigate over the next week, the low point, it would seem, of Jesus' earthly ministry, this moment of death and crucifixion. And somewhere in our hearts, in our psyches, we're going to try and process the fact that this thing was for us. This was done for us. And then we're going to try and move from there to the joy and the life of Resurrection Sunday, the highest and holiest day of the year. We're going to try and hold deeply the cost of Good Friday while recognizing that essentially we are people of the resurrection. And that is a good story. This is a wonderful week in which to follow Jesus together, and I'm so glad I get to do it with you fine people. I got to go away last week, and my wife and I went away with our small group, and Aaron just stepped in here and did a wonderful job. I would say this: if you have a small group, you should go away with them, because you will learn things about your small group that you didn't know before you went away with your small group. And if it goes well, you will end up with a better small group. If it doesn't go well, you may no longer have a small group. And I'll just leave you to imagine which we have. No, we had a great time with our group, and one of the great little girls that is in our group, she grabbed me during the time we were away, and she looked at me and she said, "You stole all the donuts." And I said, I did temporarily. She said, "Did you eat them all?" I said, "No." She said, "Good, because you'd have got sick." And I was like, oh, I just, even stealing the donuts hasn't changed the care that she has for my personal health. In a moment, we're going to jump into the last part of Matthew chapter 6. If you have a text you want to open, you can prepare. We're going to start from verse 25. Before we get in there, I would just say during Holy Week, we are still in this cycle of 24/7 prayer. We still have spots to cover this week. This is a great week to jump in for the first time and say, I want to participate in this thing that my community is doing. We've had about 500 hours filled. We've had lots of people sign up, but probably I think we're somewhere in the high 70s in terms of people. That means there's some of you in the room that may not have signed up yet. And so jump in on this Holy Week and pray with us as a community, for us as a community to well articulate the message of Jesus, to invite people in that are on the outside, and to be the community of God in the world around us. Matthew chapter 6, verse 25. I forgot my own copy of the scriptures. I have the smallest print in the world, and so we'll see what we can do with this. "Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food? And the body more important than clothes?" No teenager said yes to that, by the way. "Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See the flowers of the fields grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today, and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, 'What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear?' For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." Jesus, as we unpack this, would you speak to our hearts? You know the some of us that carry worry deeply. The some of us that have walked into this space worried. The some of us that feel we will leave this space worried. The some of us who would say worry is a way of life. And we look at this world and recognize there is a lot to worry about. And yet we want to take your word seriously. And we long to become more like you. So please speak to us. Challenge and change our hearts. Bring real transformation to your people. For those of us that are exploring faith, who are uncertain about faith, who feel like we're close to stepping away from faith, would you capture us with a new picture of you? Draw us into your presence. Amen. We start with these words. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry. A difficult thing to do. Jesus tells us that for the very basic things of life, we don't need to be concerned. Last week, Aaron demonstrated to us through Maslow's hierarchy of needs some of the deep needs that we find within ourselves, some of the goals that we perhaps have for ourselves. And at the very bottom, you have the physiological needs that include things like food and clothing. I honestly think Maslow missed a very basic need in his list of needs, because I think we all might say now that this is the real list. At the very core of things, we need good Wi-Fi. But to give Maslow credit, he died like 20 years before the internet was discovered or created. And so maybe he gets a pass on that. Jesus says the very basic things in life we do not need to worry about. They will be provided for. And yet, just by being told not to worry, you, like me, may find it's actually easier to begin to worry. If not worrying is the goal and the thing that we should move away from, for some of us, we would say, I automatically veer in that direction. The prohibition on worry makes me want to or feel the need, perhaps, to worry. It reminds me of a story. Some years ago in my early life, I was doing my driving test. I was practicing with my dad. It was our first lesson. And he took me out. My dad's style was to say, let's just go to the highway. It's going to be clear on Sunday afternoon. We're just going to hit 70. Just like put your foot to the pedal and just go. And so we just went. And then we took a couple more turns. And he said, okay, we need to stop and get some gas. And so you're just going to pull into the gas station here. Just don't crash in to the pump. So what did I do? I pulled in and crashed into something that looked very like this. Just the sense of don't go in that direction felt like it pulled me in this direction. And I sat there for a moment waiting for an explosion, and none came. Fortunately, I'm still here. And he just looked at me and he said, I told you not to crash into the pump. And I said, yeah, and I would never have crashed into that pump had you not mentioned it in the first place. The feel of like, oh, do not worry can send our minds spiraling. Perhaps we even say, I have started to worry about worrying. And yet Jesus tells us that we don't need to do it. I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? And yet we know those things are on the hierarchy of needs for a reason. We need those things. We need food. We need clothes. If you're reading this for the first time, you may justly have a couple of questions. One might be this: is Jesus being naive? Is he being naive about the way that the world operates? Shouldn't we be concerned about these things? Other critics of this passage have said this: this is idealism in the face of the reality of this world. The reality of this world is that the paranoid survive, that those who gather resources keep getting more resources, and those who are careless with resources end up with nothing. It's one of a couple of passages that critics have gone to that have said, look, Jesus doesn't know what he's talking about. His teaching doesn't apply to the world today. Love your enemies has been another one, and this is a second. This is a thing that maybe just doesn't work. And even if we're honest, his examples might give us some pause. Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. And our tension might be, I've seen birds die in droves. What does that mean for us? How about the second example? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin, yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? And yet, if you've tried to garden in Colorado, you know how hard it is to keep anything alive. Jesus' examples may even give us some pause and say, well, how do I trust myself to this? How do I, on the basis of birds that I see die and flowers that last a day or two in our hideous climate, how do I trust my provision, my family's provision, the provision of those who rely on me into the future, on this idea that God, you will provide for me? And Jesus rounds all this off by throwing in this little term that he has for his disciples that he uses multiple times. At the end, he refers to them as this, "O you of little faith." It's actually not a verb, it's actually a noun, "aligo pastoi." It's little faiths. You little faiths. Can you not trust that everything will be fine? Jesus' argument seems to be this. He tells his followers that his Father, now their Father, will take care of them. And with all of that tension that's there in what he says, the questions I have that I would bring are these: can I do my part? Can I stop worrying about the future? Am I putting enough away? Am I collecting enough resources? Am I grabbing my share of the pie that seems like it's fast diminishing as people around me grab more and more and more? Can I do that? As a follower of Jesus, I would actually say if Jesus was present with me, I'd probably find it fairly easy to do that. Robert Murray M. Shan said this: if I could hear Christ praying for me in the next room, I would not fear a million enemies or, by extension, provision. Yet distance makes no difference. He is praying for me. Seems like if he was here, I'd find it easier, but his reminder is wonderful. Jesus is praying for me regularly, for my needs, for my faith, for my journey, and those that I love. He's praying too for you, for each of us in the room. Can I do my part? And will he do his part? If I take this risk, if I trust him, if I stop worrying about what is next, will he show up in the ways that I need him to show up? So to unpack this a little bit, I actually want to go back to last week. If you look at the start of the text, if you have it in front of you, the first word we read is the word therefore. It's a Greek word dia. It simply means what came before, because of what has been there. So if you ever are reading scriptures and you see the word therefore, when you read therefore, think what came before. It means that you and I are supposed to have grasped something that was present before, something that has already been shared with us. And so we're going to go back and we're going to kind of look at the passage from last week, try and pull it into this passage, maybe look at a specific example of it, and also do the challenge that Aaron set for me last week, which was to do the work he was supposed to do last week. He said, I can't answer this question, it's not in my text. And I said, well, you kind of took some parts of my text, which were the easy parts to do, and so I'll try and catch up. If I don't do my job today, then we have a podcast. And you can tune into the podcast, and eventually, somewhere, your pertinent questions will be answered and we'll all be on the same page. This is the bulk of the text from last week, or the conclusion. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And if you have a text in front of you, it may say money, may say mammon. And really, either translation is good. Money tends to pull it more into our world today. Mammon is the specific Greek word that is used that, that could speak to a foreign deity, could speak to a false god, could just speak to the system in general. So if you find yourself, if you're like, I'm an enemy of the system, I don't like any systems, I don't like government, then this is the passage for you, potentially. No one can serve two masters. Jesus reminds us that if we're attracted to and devoted to money, then ultimately it will pull us away from following the creator who made us. It's not possible to serve both of them. One will have your heart and one won't have your heart. So what we read today is deeply related to that. It's examining what it is to kind of like, what it is to chase after God and to leave the other behind. It's the natural conclusion. If I'm not concerned about money, if that's not my goal, if building wealth isn't my primary interest, the passage today is the outworking of that. You cannot serve God and money. And the challenge to a reader of the day, if they were honest, would have been this. Has anyone really done this? Or at least, don't most people really serve mammon to some degree, serve money to some degree? We're all part of this, and even the rabbis that they followed were, it seemed, deeply interested in money. The Pharisees were certainly deeply interested in money. The Sadducees of the day, the religious rulers were all compelled by money. Money was the system back then, just as money is the system now. So when you heard Jesus say something like this, your question might be, yes, show me someone who's done that. Show me someone who really lives that way, and maybe I'll pay attention. And beautifully, that's exactly what Jesus does. Keep your finger in Matthew chapter 6. If you've got a text in front of you, we're going to flip over to Luke's biography of Jesus' life, to Luke chapter 5. And I want you to just capture hold of the beautiful way that Jesus shows to Peter, one of his first followers, what it is to truly choose God over mammon. To truly choose God over mammon. Chapter 5, verse 1 to 3. One day, as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, the people were crowding around him, listening to the word of God. He saw at the water's edge two boats left there by fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, who would later be called Peter, and asked him to put out a little from the shore. Then he sat down and taught the people from the boat. Jesus begins by asking Peter for a favor. Now, if you've read back a little bit early in the story, Peter has asked Jesus to heal his mother-in-law. Some people wouldn't have done the same thing, but Peter does. And so he owes Jesus. This is a very reciprocal culture. And so Jesus asks a favor, Peter obeys. He actually asks Peter to do something that is very difficult to do and is actually perfectly in Peter's skill set. Imagine what it takes on a big lake to hold a boat in place still enough that somebody can actually preach to a crowd. It's a distinct skill that Peter has. Jesus begins by asking Peter for help. And then he says something kind of insulting. Remember, Peter has been working all night. This is a culture that fished at night. The fish of the Lake of Galilee would rise to the surface at night, and there would be times where you would not be able to throw a spear into a section of the lake without hitting a fish of some kind. They gathered in these big sections, and so people would go out with nets at night. They would throw them into the water, and they would catch a ton of fish, unless they weren't in the places where the fish were, and then they would catch nothing. And Peter's had one of those nights. If you've done sails, you know this feeling. It's that day of just did not go as it was supposed to go today. Just felt like everything that felt like a hot lead was a cold lead. It's like that day where you just wanna wipe it and start again. And Peter's had that kind of day. He knows his job, he knows today wasn't good, and tomorrow he hopes will be a different day. And then Jesus does this. When he had finished speaking, he said to Peter, "Put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch." This is deeply insulting. Peter knows there's no fish out there at this time of day. And now this guy from the mountains has come and told him, who lives by the lake, "Go catch some fish. Go earn some provision. Go make some money for your family so they can be fed." It's kind of like us in Colorado here. Any natives in the house today? We've got to have some. There's always a couple, right? Not many, but a couple. Imagine if you guys, you left Colorado for the first time, and you made your way out to California, and you're watching the surfers out there, and there's this guy here, this is Kelly Slater, the greatest surfer of all time. And you say to Kelly, you know what? I know you haven't caught any waves today. What you need to do is this. Just swim a little further out in that direction. The waves are coming. I get a sense of it. Just go out there. You're going to catch the best wave you have ever caught in your life. That's a great sound going on right there. I'm like, ding, 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 ding. It's got to tell me something. Maybe I'm supposed to pay attention to something. Imagine doing that to a guy who has spent his entire life on the waves. He knows surfing, and you don't know surfing. And this is exactly the same situation that they find themselves in. Peter knows fishing, and Jesus comes from the hill country in Nazareth. He does not know fishing at all. Go out into the deep water and let down the nets for a catch. Simon gives this answer that in English doesn't really come across, but it's actually kind of like this irritated answer. The word master is kind of like, it's kind of like boss or chief. Whenever I used to go to Haiti a lot, the guys selling in the marketplace would always call me big man. I think it was, they tapped into my sense of my brothers are all taller than I am, so they were trying to encourage me to buy something, and this language is somewhat similar. It's a little bit sarcastic. It's not the word that we'll come across later for Lord. It's like boss, chief. We've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets. The language is kind of like, yeah, okay. You're in charge. You're a rabbi. You know everything. If you say to us, go let down some nets, we're gonna paddle our way out there. We're going to wait for the wave to come, even if it doesn't come. Because it's you, we'll do it. Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything. But because you say so, I will let down the nets. Peter drags his hard-working crew back out to try fishing at a time when there are no fish, even though they've gone out when there is fish, and they've caught nothing. When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. You didn't shout to the shore to say that you caught fish or shout to the other boat because water carries. You just wave. And these other guys come over and no one can believe that there's this much fish in the boat. There shouldn't be fish at this time. They've clearly discovered some new source for fish that wasn't there before. Perhaps a spring has emerged from the bottom of the lake, but for some reason, with Jesus there, there are fish. When there should be no fish, there is provision. When there should be no provision. And now the goal of these fishermen is to keep this as quiet as possible, because if anybody knows, then they'll be here instantly. And this could be the lottery ticket they've dreamed of. Two boatloads of fish is a big deal, but imagine being able to come back to the same place every day and catch another couple of boatloads of fish. You're set up for life. Everything is well. It's this story. It's a lottery win. You're on easy street for the rest of your life. What do you do when you find perpetual wealth? What do you do when you find the guarantee that bread will be there tomorrow and the next day, and there is no scenario will stop the bread from coming? What do you do when you know that there's the clothing that you need for the rest of your life? What do you know when all of your needs will be taken care of? What do you do, with that? This is what they've found. This is what Jesus has found with them and for them. Something about the moment grabs Simon's attention, this kind of burly fisherman who's been around a bit, who's seen all sorts of things, has this moment where Jesus is no longer to him master or chief or boss or big man. Something has changed. Go away from me, Lord. Curious, master, in a different sense. I am a sinful man. For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. The lottery ticket has come in. Perpetual wealth is on the table. What happens next? What happens next? And Jesus comes alongside Peter and says this. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will fish for people. No longer, Simon, will your life be centered around catching fish that are alive that will become dead. Your life will now be centered around catching people who are dead and will become alive." He offers Peter something that ties deeply into the skills that Peter has built over a lifetime, but offers a whole new life. All he has to do to take it is to leave behind perpetual wealth. All he has to do to take it is to leave behind the guarantee of bread tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. So they pulled their boats up on the shore, left everything, and followed him. We never get to know what happens to the lottery ticket. Who gets to keep it? Do the fish just rot on the shore? Do they get handed out to those that need it? We just get left with this story of a rabbi who calls a follower and says, "Let's leave behind perpetual wealth and chase after something different." What do you do when you find perpetual wealth? If you're Jesus, you walk away from it. If you're Jesus, you walk away from it. And Peter, for the first time in his life, genuinely meets someone who has chosen God over money. He's met someone that has chosen God over money. Jesus tells his followers they can choose God over money because their Father will take care of them. But he demonstrates what it is to make that decision as a human being living this life. That's why it's so important that on Holy Week especially, but at all times, we recognize the fact that this Jesus is God in human flesh. Not just God, not just human, but something that encapsulates both of those things. Because he lives this same tension that you and I feel, I've got to get enough, I've got to provide, I've got to get more. And yet, he leaves behind perpetual wealth. He becomes someone who has genuinely chosen God over money. Somewhere, the key to understanding everything that we read last week and everything that we've read this week is in this passage. Do not worry, saying, "What shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear?" For the pagans run after all those things. People of other faiths, people of different nations. The nations is probably the best translation there. And your heavenly Father knows that you need them, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. The key to all of it is the key that Jesus demonstrates. It is to seek the kingdom, this bigger thing, rather than wealth that goes on forever. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. So maybe a question that might be a fair question at that point is, well, what does it mean to seek first the kingdom? That seems like somewhat old school language. How do I actually do that practically in everyday life? The word seek is kind of a play on a word that he already used earlier. When he talked about the nations or the Gentiles, he said he used this word to run after or to seek eagerly. And it seems like his invitation is that in the same way you see people run after the thing that they are most passionate about, you and I are invited to run after the kingdom. How many of you have tracked with this story that I love just because I kind of love cryptocurrency? This is a guy called James Howells. He did this thing called mining for crypto. If you don't know what that means at this point, then there's no hope for you. You're going to get left behind in the new generation. But he did this early on, and so he had 8,000 bitcoins that he stored on a hard drive. To give you some perspective, if you're not in the consignari, then one Bitcoin is now worth $65,000, $66,000, and this guy had 8,000 of them. And then he put them on a hard drive on a shelf, and then he got rid of the hard drive. And so somewhere that hard drive is now located in this landfill in the middle of Wales. And he has been doing everything he can for 10 years now to recover his beloved hard drive. He's now trying to use AI to scan the whole site so he can figure out where is my hard drive with my perpetual wealth on it. He's chasing after it harder and harder every day. He's hired incredible lawyers to fight against the council who say, no, you can't dig a landfill. It's an environmental concern. You might, I don't know, let off some gas or something like that. And this is this guy who is doing that thing. He's running after it eagerly. If you've lost something that you have value in, then you know what it is to chase after this. My wife and I were on a trip once, and the stone fell out of her engagement ring. We just guessed it might be at a McDonald's somewhere that we'd stopped, and so I called every McDonald's in this big circumference just in the hope that someone had wandered through a parking lot and found a stone and handed it in and that I had got the right McDonald's. You know what it is to lose something and seek after it eagerly. And this is the kind of example Jesus grabs for us. Imagine what it is to have something that you know that you desperately want to find. He invites us to run after the kingdom like those that are most passionate about wealth. If you've seen someone who is so intentional, so passionate about gathering as much wealth as possible, it gives you just a window into how Jesus says, seek after the kingdom. This is his invite to us. But still, the kingdom, what is it? How do you do that? It's kind of abstract and mysterious, especially if you're new to faith or find yourself on that fringe. How do we seek after the kingdom? How do we genuinely become kingdom people, not people of perpetual wealth, not people longing for lottery tickets? And yet we often forget that regularly in Jesus' language, he reminds us that you can't detach the king from his kingdom. It seems our primary way of chasing after the kingdom is to seek to stay close to the king. It's to seek to stay close to the king. In John chapter 15, he reminds his disciples, remain in me as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Perhaps you read a version that would use the term abide instead of remain, and that's a great word for that situation. Andrew Murray said this, oh, that you would come and begin simply to listen to his word and to ask only the one question, does he really mean that I should abide in him? The answer his word gives is so simple and so sure. By his almighty grace, you are now in him. That same almighty grace will indeed enable you to abide in him. By faith, you have become partakers of the initial grace. By that same faith, you can enjoy the continuous grace of abiding in him. The simplest way to seek the kingdom is to stay close to the king whose kingdom it is. Now, in the midst of that, you'll experience hardship. I'll experience hardship. In the midst of that, there are doubts and wrestlings. After Easter, we're going to turn to this series where we'll actually look at some of the reasons that we doubt and acknowledge that actually doubt isn't a bad thing that it's been proclaimed to be. It's a natural counterpart to wrestling with faith. But Jesus' message to us is stay close to me, abide with me, don't leave. Don't just come, but stay. Come close, stay close. That is the easiest path to seeking the kingdom. But for many of us, for me included, I might say, what am I seeking beyond that, first, before that? What means more to me than the king and his kingdom? And already I'm aware of things that I hold dearly, that I might say, often I choose that first. That the kingdom ranks second, third, fourth, fifth, and perhaps if I'm honest, the king as well. What can I do to seek that kingdom and to truly seek that king whose kingdom it is? And so I have a few options for you, a few ideas. Jesus' invite is to choose something other than the system of money and gathering that we practice often today. So something you might want to try is this. Practice saying no to wants. Practice saying no to wants. If you're like me, your mind can be grabbed by 100 things a week. You see something in Costco, always Costco, and you're like, I want that. I just want it. And so I have the resources, so I'm going to get it. Over Easter, I fasted from buying books, because I buy a lot of books. And I recognized in myself this tension, which is that I buy books to help me solve problems, to tell me I'm making progress on something. And yet I have so many books that I've already read and could read again, and so many books that I actually haven't yet read. They've sat on a shelf for 6 months, a year and a half, 2 years. And actually, I've had the joy over this Lenten season of pulling some of those books down and saying, oh, hello, old friend. It's so good to be with you again. Or reading books for the first time that I'd previously bought. It's taught me to say no to some wants and helped me take a fast from some casual buys, some just dispersing of the wealth that God has given me in this casual way. Someone once said to me in a beautifully challenging way, do you know if you casually spend $27 a day, by the end of the year, you've spent $10,000? And every time I spend $27 on anything now, I say, ouch, like that's part of the $10,000 that I have just kind of frittered away. Third one, apply a kingdom first principle. Let me unpack that for you for just a second. There are things at some point that you might be called to say no to, like a catch of fish or something more appropriate for today's society. Unless you've practiced being able to live out a kingdom principle beforehand, when the grand thing comes, when the big catch is offered, you won't be ready to say no. Find ways to stand up for kingdom principles in small ways in the world that you operate right now. And fourthly, give the king your attention, because seeking the kingdom requires staying close to the king. This is a psalm of a guy called David while he was hiding in the desert from a man who was trying to kill him. In amongst all his needs and amongst all his wants, capture hold of the heartbeat of this psalm because I think it's important. You, God, are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you. In a dry and parched land where there is no water, in a place where there was no food, and a place where there was no water, this man writes a psalm and says, God, all I actually really want and all I actually need is you. I long for you in the same way my body longs for water. The preacher Charles Spurgeon once said that he believed followers of Jesus should read this psalm every single morning of their lives because it captures what it is to seek the kingdom by seeking the king. Ronald Rollheiser says this, you must try to pray so that in your prayer, you open yourselves in such a way that sometime, perhaps not today, but sometime, you are able to hear God say to you, I love you. These words addressed to you by God are the most important words you will ever hear. The most important words you will ever hear. There is something transformative in that when you find yourself close to this king. And know for the first time, or the second time, or the 20th time, that this king is delighted that you and I are in his presence. You might say this, that without abiding with our king, nothing will quite be right. When abiding in our king, nothing will really be wrong. Because the beauty of Jesus' teaching is not actually that God will provide. He does often, and there's all sorts of stories that we could unpack that say God has provided in incredible ways. The most beautiful part of his teaching is this, that in whatever you face, whatever your needs are, however small you feel the things that you are given might be, you are loved, and he is present with you, and his kingdom will come, and eventually his will be done. That's the promise of this text. Today we celebrate Palm Sunday. In a moment, we're going to have kids fill this space waving palms in a joyful way. But for a moment, I want you to picture Palm Sunday 2,000 years ago. There's this moment where Jesus walks into what will be the hardest week of his life. a moment where he walks in and will be betrayed, a moment that will lead to his crucifixion, a moment where he'll face perhaps his greatest temptation. As Jesus comes into Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, the road splits, and one pathway goes to the temple, to this spiritual place, and the other part goes to the law courts and the seat of government. And Jesus has a crowd with him cheering his name, yelling, "The king has come." And he has this moment where he gets to make a decision. Does he lead a crowd that could become an army to overthrow the government? Or does he go to the temple and teach in a road that leads to crucifixion and death? Does he choose wealth, or does he choose God? Does he choose mammon, or does he choose his father? Does he choose this world, or does he choose this kingdom? And imagine for a moment what it is to hear the cheers of a crowd who are waving and shouting and screaming his name and cheering that the new king has come. And just like turning his back on perpetual wealth, just like saying no to catches of fish, Jesus chooses the temple way, the kingdom way. He models that for you and for I. And in his head, I wonder if there's something like this. Oops, that's me. "You God are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you in a dry and parched land where there is no water." This king, our king, modeled what it is to seek first the kingdom. And we copy him. So I'm going to invite you to stand with me. And we're going to spend some moments processing before the children come. Perhaps you are deeply aware of the worries of this life, the needs that are so present and so, at times, correct. You need food, you need clothes. Perhaps you recognize your own temptation to worry about worrying, to hold it so deeply, to live a life of constant worry. Perhaps you're deeply set on chasing wealth and wanting to leave enough for people that come after you. Perhaps you find it hard to say no to things that go against kingdom principles. Perhaps you recognize the way that you grab a whole bunch of wants, that you make a load of casual buys. The invitation is to remind yourself that we're here to seek the kingdom first, and we do that by seeking the king. Aaron and the team are going to lead us, and they're going to seamlessly lead us into this joyful moment where the kids will come. But hold in your hearts for this moment, Psalm 63. "You God are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you, my whole being longs for you, in a dry and parched land where there is no water." Stand or sit or sing as you feel called. Jesus, would you speak to us in this moment? Amen.
If you've been touched by this ministry and you want that to spread to others, you might consider partnering with us financially. You can give online at southfellowship.org/give. Thanks for listening and have a great rest of your day.